Hey, and welcome back to Extra Features Interview. Today we have a film with all but the band U2. And I guess I really want to use the term fanatics. I guess Dave Barry, the director, is with me. He'll argue with me if that's the right word or not, but I really feel it is. Dream Out Loud's the name of the film. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So I guess we got to start off right at the beginning. How big a U2 fan are you?
You know, I'm a pretty big fan. The music's impacted me a lot through my life. I became a fan when I was 12 years old, and I'm 50 now. So it's been a big part of my life. You know, the thing that's unique about it with me is that they're just a few years older than me. So it seems like whatever they were going through in life, I was just about to go through or going through. And that made their songwriting incredibly relevant to me. Because the big issues in life that I was questioning was exactly what they were dealing with at the same time.
So what was your first album then?
October, 1982.
And
I saw – the way I got hooked on YouTube is, you know, you're talking pre-MTV days, right?
Yeah.
We had just gotten cable TV. I lived in New Jersey and as a kid. And we had there was this cable access show that was showing music videos, and there were these four guys out on a barge, and they were playing this music, and they were Irish, and I was Irish, you know, I had Irish heritage, and it didn't sound like anything else, and it didn't look like anything else, and the kids that they had like on the barge watching them, they looked like they could have been my cousins, you know, it just really it was relevant to me, it resonated, and I had to know who these guys were. And you know, at that time, you didn't have the internet, so that meant going to the bookstore at the mall and reading every single thing I could find on them, you know? And, you know, I had pretty conservative parents, so I didn't actually get to see them until 1987. Wow. So for 5 years, it was just reading whatever I could on them. And you know, of course, I bought every album, and, you know, this is pre-CD. You know, I would get it on cassette. And when I got my driver's license, there was never not a U2 tape in the car, you know? Finally when I saw them, you know, they're an interesting thing. I know that you're not a fan, and I would tell you to really understand them, you have to see them live. When you see them live, it's a different thing. And the reason for that is that there's just something, the sum is greater than the parts. There's something about them when they play live, and that's what happened to me in 87 that cemented the deal, really. You know, that's a very impressionable age. You're 17 years old, 18 years old. You're just starting to figure out the world. And I see you too at the Brendan Byrne Arena, the Meadowlands Arena in New Jersey. And I was at the very top of the back of the arena, and it didn't matter. I was just in the same room with these guys finally. And there was a spot in the show where Bono takes this spotlight and he shined it around the audience. And when that light hits you, for me anyway, I can't speak to anybody else, of course, but when it hit me, the you know, 100 yards across the arena just shrunk to nothing. And it was like a connection was made, you know? And that stuck with me for the rest of my life. And so that's why I'm a fan, because the music is just very relevant.
And I also want to get, throughout your film, you really discuss the YouTube family. And that's the way I go to describe it, the YouTube family. I mean, do you know all these people now after doing the film, or did you meet them?
You know, everybody I interviewed, I do. They're all Facebook friends now. My Facebook friend list went from, you know, maybe 150 people to, I don't know what it is, like 700 people now. And I do know them all by face and by name, and I chat with them occasionally. It's an interesting thing. You know, before the internet, you didn't really know any other U2 fans, but around 2000, 2001, the Elevation tour, that's when they released Pitiful Day, right? A lot of people know that song. So the internet became a big deal, and they had all these you know, fan sites that had forums, and in these forums you could meet other fans, and they started to have you know, fan meetups before shows and things like that. And that's when you really started to make, you know, U2 friends, or that's when that, because they do call it a family now, right? And that's really where the genesis started, was on the Elevation tour around 2000. And these people, they all started to stay in touch. They started meeting each other. That was also the first tour where they started to do a lot of GA ticket lineups. So people would, I mean, you're right. They are very dedicated. I won't use the fanatical word. I'll say dedicated. And people would show up, you know, a day in advance and start waiting in line, you know, to have that chance to be right up against the railing.
Well,
they met each other, you know what I mean? And they would talk and they would get to know each other, and very strong friendships were formed.
Well, you say that. The people talk in your video that the concert people in Brazil line up a week ahead of time.
They do. They are because think about it this way. If this music, I wouldn't line up a week in advance. I couldn't do it. But if you have that kind of time, this music has meant so much to these people, and U2 goes there once, maybe every 10 years. So this is your one chance to see them. And now everybody's in their 50s, you know, approaching 60. You just don't know whether you're going to get another chance. So, and a lot of these fans now are in their 30s and 40s. They have expendable income. So, you know, it's important to them. It's not just about the band. It's about all those people too. I would liken it to a week-long holiday or vacation, and they're hanging out with all their U2 friends, and the big celebration is the show that happens.
I don't want to focus on the negative here, because I think the U2 people listening would be upset with me. What happens if the band breaks up?
It has to come to an end eventually, right? It does. I don't think that they will break up. They've said that themselves. They've said that they've been in it long enough now that nobody gets out of U2 alive. That's what they said, okay? But there will come a point in time where they don't want to do this anymore. They're not going to do the Rolling Stones, you know, play into our 70s or 80s things. At least that's what they've said so far. So what does that mean for the future? U2 fans, there will be a big hole when that happens. But they still have like yearly meetups that they're doing. Like there's a yearly meetup in Ireland at a place called the Church, which is a restaurant bar that you know, fans will meet at when they're playing in Dublin. And now they have a yearly meetup there. And there are tribute bands that in all different countries. There's a tribute band down in Brazil called Ultraviolet. And they play U2 songs. And so what you'll see is fans starting to gravitate towards events around that, I would imagine. But it won't be as, you know, it obviously wouldn't be the same. But it will be a chance to still continue those relationships and friendships for sure.
I've got a question. You have an interview with Bono in the film. You don't really interview anybody else. Is that you interviewing Bono, or is that you took somebody's footage?
No, that's – we did that. Okay. You know, when I had wanted to make this film since the Elevation Tour 2001, I was at the Anaheim Pond in California. It was the first time I was ever on the floor for a U2 show. And the genesis of the film is simple. I got onto the floor. I couldn't believe it. I was so stoked that I was actually going to be close to them. And I was standing next to these kids that were like 16 years old. And, you know, you start to talk to people because they're all around you. You're all milling about and you're crammed into a tiny space. And these kids couldn't wait to see Beautiful Day, right? 16 years old. I'm 31. They had never heard of Pride. They'd never heard of Sunday Bloody Sunday. Never heard of any of the big U2 songs. They just couldn't wait to see Beautiful Day. And their excitement was just as much as mine. And I realized that this was a generational thing now. There was a story to tell here. So it took me 17 years to finally figure out how to tell it, and the invention of crowdfunding allowed me to actually raise some money to be able to go out and do it. And, you know, we asked immediately once we knew we were going to make the film, because I am a filmmaker. I work in professional film and television. That's what I do. And my producer does as well. So we sent our letters out to publicists and management and asked for an interview. And of course we got the initial rejection. They never even brought it up with the band, but I knew that I was going to be filming out while they're on tour and I was going to get a chance to see these guys. And I talked to them about it. Well, we did, you know, one famous thing that, or I wouldn't say famous, but one mantra we had making this film was, if you don't ask, you don't get. And that was given to me by a great English friend now who is a U2 fan. His name is Aaron Govern. He's in the film and he was like an advisor to me as I was making this. And he kept saying, David, if you don't ask, you don't get. So, you know, I see Bono. I say, Bono, we're making this film. And the first thing he says to me is he laughs. He says, I'm mad for making the film, right? Like, you know, you don't know what you're getting into here. But I said, you know, can we do an interview? And he said, yeah, we need to make that happen. We should do that. So I was like, whoa, there you go. You got the man to say yes. It took a year from them to actually make it happen. Because they are four of the busiest people I've ever seen, you know, and I work in film and television. I've never seen people as busy as these guys are. But they care that much. They really do. The Edge and Bono were incredibly supportive and incredibly helpful. I mean, we have 36 musical tracks of U2's in the film. We had almost no budget for music, but we asked, you know, we said, can we show the film in a private event in a theater to U2 fans, and can we stream it a couple times on Facebook? And they said, yes. You know, we gave them what we could for it, and they said the support was incredible. So anyway, it took a year to get them in the film. We wanted 5 minutes. It looked like we were only going to get three or four, and he patiently stayed longer because it was a funny thing that happened that day. We were in Laval, Canada. They were rehearsing for their next tour, and we were there a few days early, and we talked to him. We said, Bono, can we do the interview because, you know, we're going to show the film soon? And he said, yes, we can do that. Are you going to be here on Saturday? And I said, I can be if I have to be. He said, come back Saturday. The problem is that right next to me there was a reporter for – a Montreal newspaper, I guess. And he heard him say that, and they put it out into the world on the radio and other places that Bono's going to be there and signing autographs on Saturday. So 300 people showed up, right? And, you know, I'm sitting out there and I'm thinking, okay, we're going to get this chance. He gets there. U2's security took us aside and moved us to where we needed to be. Bono being Bono took time to meet every single person that wanted to talk to him before he got to us. And so then, you know, now we're crushed up against their rehearsal time, and he still took the time and answered every, you know, the questions we had, and then off he went. But it was, for me, it was an interesting thing. I know that's a long story, but and you can cut it up how you need to.
That's a great story.
The very interesting thing about it was that once I asked him if he would do this, and these guys were heroes of mine, and you're going to learn a lot about your heroes when you ask them to do something like that. And I have to tell you that in working in film and television, it's not just because I'm a U2 fan, you meet all kinds of people. And the rule of thumb is that you never want to meet somebody you really like because typically they're going to let you down. They're not going to be who you hope they are, right? Well, Bono and Edge far exceed anything that I could thought that they would be in terms of generosity, in terms of their willingness to help, in terms of their who they are. They, you know, I couldn't ever say a bad thing about the guys because they have been incredibly supportive and helpful. And that's an amazing thing.
Wow, that was a great answer. I'm trying to go, what else I have? How did you organize everything? Because it looks like you shot in England. I would say you went to other places, Ireland for sure.
The stats are in the film. When we made it, we tried to raise $40,000 to do this, and in filmmaking, that is nothing. Now, there are some U2 fans who were upset, actually, that I was crowdfunding to do this, and they felt $40,000 was outlandish. And I tried to supply what a real film budget would look like. People are either going to accept it or not, but $40,000 is nothing to make a documentary where you're going to be visiting all these places. You know, I've been parts of shoots where we spent hundreds of thousands of dollars for a 30-second commercial. That's real-world production, right? And that's what I do. Fortunately, I own cameras, and I have post gear, and I have all this stuff. So we wanted to raise just enough to be able to do it. Initially, I looked at it, and I talked to Amanda McHugh, my producer, who happens to also be a huge U2 fan. And I said, you know, U2 fans travel. They're doing this Joshua Tree 30th anniversary tour. I think we could go to 5 cities, you know, major cities where U2 fans are going to travel to, and we will, you know, interview anybody who wants to be interviewed there. And I think we could probably get 50 to 100 people, and we got something to work with. Well, like everything in U2's world, it just grew from that. The one thing we knew is that when you do a film like this, you have to invite everybody. Anybody who wants to tell their story has to have a chance to, because, you know, this is a 40-plus year relationship now, and you can't – nobody owns it. You know what I mean? You can't say, okay, well, you can't tell your story. You have to – anybody who wants to. fortunately, I'm a good enough, you know, I have enough experience editing that I knew I could get, you know, these people into a film. You turn it into a conversation the way I did, where it just cuts and cuts and cuts, right? But what happened was we got responses were, you know, 150 people, and it was all over the place. There was no way we could do it in five cities. So it turned from that to instead of flying to five cities and doing it, I was going to be in a car driving. And I ended up driving 12,000 miles in 6 weeks. We went through five countries. There are people from 25 nations represented in the film, and they range in age from 12 to 74. And there are more than 200 U2 fans in the film. So it is, I think, a wonderful cross-section of, you know, what the U2 fan community looks like.
Oh, I have to agree with you. I love the 74-year-old. She's my favorite.
Wasn't she amazing?
She was absolutely awesome, and she was great. She's like, I don't know if I'm going to see him again. I'm like, you win.
And the thing is, it's a, you know, something that I haven't yet been able to expand upon in the film, and I hope to, is that this is a real, I mean, Bono said it himself, is that I don't refer to them as fans. It's a different kind of relationship. But everybody that works for U2 thinks the same way about it. They've had the same crew members working for them for 30 years, you know, 40 years. Their head sound guy, Joe O'Herlihy, there's never been a U2 show without him. So that you're talking about going back to, he's in his 70s now. But these people, because of that, they treat the U2 fans like extended family. So we're talking about the 72-year-old. Everybody calls her GA mom. Or for the younger kids now, there's probably GA grandma, right? Well, when she's up front, they will make sure they come out to check on her, the crew guys. They will make sure she has water. A couple of them have even brought like a little fold-up thing that she can kneel on to rest for a minute before the show starts, right? It's an astonishing thing to see how this whole thing works, and I hope to be able to expand upon that eventually. To do that, I need to talk to a couple crew guys, and we've had some crew guys who have said yes, we would love to do something. The problem is they're so busy, we were never able to film them. But you know, we'll see what happens in the future. But I would love to be able to expand upon that because it's such a unique thing.
This may be a good question. You've seen, throughout the film, you see U2 shirts, I see U2 memorabilia, I see U2 ticket stubs. What U2 merch or whatever surprised you? You've never seen that. Like, wow, I've never seen that item.
That's a really good question. I was really amazed at some of the things that fans make. Okay. You know, like, I mean, I've seen the T-shirts. I know about all the collectible albums. I mean, my friend Aaron in Ireland, in England, he has 4,000 items in his U2 collection. It's a library of U2, right? I've seen all of these things, but the thing that astonished me are the things that people make. Right in the very beginning of the film, there's a little ashtray thing that you see, or it's a change holder. It's not an ashtray. I'm showing my age, but, it's red, and it's got the outline of the guys, and it says, I go there with you. It's right in the opening credits, right? Or we go there with you. That was made by one fan for another fan. Her name is Elsha, and she is she's very inspirational. She's in the film. And one of her mantras is, I go there with you. We go there with you. It's a line from Where the Streets Have No Name, and it's her – mantra that she uses for racing. She does a lot of marathon races. And one fan made that for her. And she had another one made, and they sent it to me as a gift. And so I put it into the film. Those are the things that amaze me. The things that the fans make. It's just unbelievable. The artwork, the paintings, the shirts, it's incredible.
Well, three things spoke to me through the film as the one that wrote on the wall when she went to visit, that blew me away. The one that had the sister that died in an automobile accident and had to go get the box of U2 cassettes, really, that hit me hard. That's the one thing she wanted about her sister was her U2 tapes.
Because it meant the world to her. I mean, it was...
I know, you know, but...
if you think about it, there's, okay, U2 is not your band, right? But there's music that means a lot to you. There's music that means a lot to everybody, right? And so for her sister, U2 was the music that resonated with her. And it was a bond that they had. So to have her cassettes, yeah. But I got choked up when she said that when I was interviewing her.
I got choked up too. But that wasn't the one that blew me away. It was the guy that made the coat.
Yep.
Oh, my. Wow. I'm just like, that guy must be in his glory. It going around the world. He's getting emails. Yeah. He must love that.
It's an astonishing thing. I mean, but it's a, and one of the people who help him with that, the girl in there, she says, you know, the magic about the Lab Coat Project was that here's this thing, and it's a way of communicating with people all around the world. And yeah, we're from a different culture. And I don't know you that well, but I'm just like you. I feel the same way about certain things, you know? And it has this way of shrinking the world, you know? It has this way of creating common ground with people. It's an amazing thing that he did.
Since
Jane. Well, and he's another good friend now, you know? And, as a matter of fact, the lab coat is almost full, and he asked me recently if I would be willing to be one of the last people with it. So it's going to come out to Maui, Hawaii, where I live, in January, and I'm going to do some photos with it, and then they will retire it. And, it will, I don't know what James's plans are with it yet. I'm not sure. I hope that he'd be willing to send it into U2 because they're going to be doing a museum in Dublin in, I think, 3 years' time. I think that'd be a wonderful piece for that, you know?
I think so. That would be awesome.
So we'll see.
Okay, I'm going to have to discuss the Joshua Tree, which you probably knew I was going to go there eventually. I mean, I'm reading all these people having these big, they have meaning to them. He buried his drumstick, yada. What does it have for you?
For me? Well, that was the first time I saw them. Gosh, I mean, the Joshua Tree, I was already a big fan by then. I can still remember. You know, this is again, this is pre-internet. It's 1987, right? And I remember the first single they released off of it was With or Without You. And I remember, you know, the radio DJ, it was WPLJ in Philadelphia that we were listening to. And they announced they're going to be playing it. And, you know, me and my buddy Chris, we were in his car and he had it tuned in. And I'll never forget, we were at a fast food drive-thru. Because you're 17 years old, right, when it came on the radio. I mean, I actually remember that moment, you know, and thinking, whoa, there's something very different about this. It's different than everything else they've done, and I like it, but I'm not sure why. And it's going to the Joshua Tree, I was in total film producer mode at that moment. So, you know, it's like I've got the GPS coordinates, and I've got people I'm interviewing, and I'm leading a trek across the desert to find this thing, and I'd never been there before. And then there it is, and there's the suitcase with all these things in it. And I was on a mission. I took some of Elsha's she designs Christmas cards. And I took some of her cards because she can't get out there to it. And I put her cards in the suitcase for her. So I was in all of this. But when it was done, I have to admit, when I was finished filming, it kind of settled in and it hit me. And I was like, whoa. This is this crazy little place out in Death Valley that is a symbol to what this album has meant to so many people. And people have gone from all over the world out here just to stand where these four Irish guys stood for probably 5 minutes because the tree looked cool. And Anton took them out there and they were complaining because it was so cold, you know, but, it does, you can feel the love that people have for that band and that album. Cause it, you know, you're 17 years old when that came out for me, for a lot of people, you know, people my age, it was an album that meant a great deal. And of course that was when there's so many things that are tied to it. You know, U2, they had started working a lot with Amnesty International in 86, 84, 85, 86. So you had all the fans who were doing the letter writing and things like that, right? And then U2 exploded and they became so big, and it just made you feel, if you were of that generation and you were a fan and you were a part of all those things, it made you feel that anything was possible. It made you feel like that you could change things. And that stuck with a lot of people. It stuck with a lot of people.
I want to go back to the box for a second because that really intrigued me. What is in the box? If you do show it, it does say U2 on it. What is in it? Just would people take stuff out of it or it just stays there?
No, they leave things there. Some people leave, they leave notes for the band. They leave mementos. They take pictures, things that meant a lot to them on their journey with U2, and it gets put in there. And then there's a couple of fans who, I'm not going to say who their names are because they'll get bombarded, but they take care of the spot out there and they help clean it up. And one of them actually will pack up things in the suitcase because otherwise it would get too full.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
He takes it to Dublin, Ireland and delivers it to, I believe it's U2's management. And I think it gets kept in a, you know, U2 has a, like a, I would imagine a warehouse space that they keep things that fans give them. So the stuff gets kept. You know, I don't know whether they actually see it. I can't say that, but I do know that it gets taken to Ireland, you know, and delivered, and then people continue to fill it up.
Okay, great. How long did you interview each person? I mean, obviously, I can see you asking them similar questions.
So, you know, the way we organized it, because how do you organize something like that? I created a little form that people could fill out online. Their name, you know, what shows they were going to be at, and a little bit of info as to, you know, what their U2 story is. And it got emailed to us. And then Amanda, being the incredible producer she is, she created these incredible, you know, Excel spreadsheets that mapped everything out. And then, you know, when you got that many people you got to interview, it's hard to keep stories straight. So she would create like a little prospectus for me every day. That, you know, the night before, and I would read through everybody's stories. And then the next day when I saw them, I was fresh, you know, with what their story was. So the trick to interviewing people like this is one of the things why I think I'm so proud of this film. If I can expand for a second, then I'll bring back.
Absolutely.
So, you know, documentaries are all about questions, right? You're either asking them or you're answering them. That's what a documentary is. And some questions are very easy to answer in a documentary. Who, what, when, where. Those ones are, you know, very straightforward. But why and how are the two very hard things to answer. And the reason I'm so proud of this film is because I think that the fans in Bono have done an incredible job of answering those two very difficult questions. Why did this relationship grow? Why is it special? How did this all happen? It's in there. It's in the film. But you're getting people to talk about things, to answer those things. You have to get them to talk about things that are very personal. And the reason I'm so proud of this film is these are not actors. These are not handpicked people. To be able to sit down and get that type of authenticity out of somebody, they have to really trust you with their story. And the way you do that is in filmmaking, you have to throw out some things. It can't be a huge crew around. There can't be a massive amount of lights and a boom guy because they're not actors. They become too wrapped up in what's going on around them and then they'll bottle up. So we went very minimally in our footprint and, you know, we used natural light as much as possible. When we were indoors, we would use a couple of lights, but we kept them fairly far away and it was just me and the producer and sometimes a PA there helping, and I could get them to settle down and get into a U2 conversation with me. And because I'm a fan, because I have lived this with them, they would forget it. As so many people would say, they forgot about the camera completely, you know? And so sometimes these interviews would be 5 minutes. Sometimes they'd be 10. Sometimes they'd be an hour and a half.
Oh, wow.
It depended on, you know, the story and what was going on with that person. And they did an incredible job. And for that reason, if I can, it probably sounds a little arrogant to say it, but I truly believe that this film will have some historic value eventually because U2 will stop playing, you know? And something like this will probably never happen again because the music industry doesn't exist this way anymore. I mean, an artist having a 40-year career that's built over time like this with an audience, I don't think it'll ever happen again. And I think that, you know, one of the things I said to Bono when I gave him a copy of the film, now I don't know whether they were able to see it or not yet, but I did say to him, I said, Bono, one of the things that I realized when I was making this film is I think this is going to be really great for maybe your grandkids and Edge's grandkids or great grandkids, because your kids grew up seeing this. They know that the songs were that important to people, but your grandkids or your great grandkids, they're going to know you were, you know, a rock star, but they're not going to know why. And this is going to show why. So I think it's going to have a lot of value down the line because of that. And I'm just amazed by these people. And the last thing I will tell you about is that, you know, so these interviews, what I did is I turned it into a conversation. It's the only way you can get all these people into the film. But on our webpage, the Dream Out Loud film webpage, I have a fan library that's searchable, and everybody's full interview is available to watch.
Oh, wow.
On the webpage. And you can be like, you can search for things like you could say the Joshua Tree, and you'll see every single thing that somebody said about the Joshua Tree, and you can click on it and hear what that person had to say about it. So it's a video library of YouTube fan experiences, and we've opened it up so people can actually film their own things now and add it to it. So it's you know, as great as the film is, I think that video library of YouTube fans is going to have even more power eventually.
Wow, that's just amazing. That is truly amazing. Did you learn anything about U2 you didn't know?
Honestly, not really. No, I mean, I some of my conversations with Aaron, I learned some things about the very early days of U2 that I didn't know about, like their original fan clubs, because none of that stuff was published. And Aaron is an encyclopedia of U2. He's one of the main correspondents at U2, which is like the unofficial U2 news site. They do incredible work at U2. And he is an absolute encyclopedia of U2. So some of the early things, like the original fan club was called Sister Sister, and it was run by Larry Mullen Jr.'s sister. Larry's the drummer of U2. I had no idea, you know. So some of the inner workings he kind of explained to me. But you know, most everything I had already known. I'll say again, the Bono and Edge and Adam, I didn't get a chance to speak to Larry about anything, but Bono and Edge and Adam, I learned a lot about their character. And you know, I knew that they were good guys, thoroughly decent guys, but let me give you an example. This is probably the most awe-inspiring moment out of all the awe-inspiring moments I had filming this film. So I'm going to go back to Elsha again. Elsha is the girl who you see laying on the bed. Elsha has
a 12-year-old. I think she's 12.
No, Elsha is in her 30s. She is paralyzed and she can't move. She has a hard time getting to things, and she didn't think she was going to be able to get to any shows on this tour, on the Joshua Tree tour, right? So I interviewed her, and I have a very strong connection with Elsha. She's an amazing person. She's a dear friend. She's Auntie Elsha to my son, okay? So Elsha asked me, because she knew we were going to be at a lot of the shows, and she has a very special bond with the band. Anytime she's at a show, Bono will come out to see her, or they will do something, okay? They just have a very strong connection with this girl. And it's hard to explain unless you've actually met her and you've been around her, and then you feel it, and you know why. She's just a very, very special person. So she asked if I could maybe, if I was going to be around them, if I could try and FaceTime with them, because so she could say hi, because she wasn't going to be going to Joshua Tree shows. I said, sure, and a few fans were trying to do this. We almost got them in Chicago, and it didn't work out. And then about a week later in Tampa, when I talked to him, he was coming up, and the security guys were there, and I know the security guys by now by name, and they knew who I was. And I said to Liam, one of the security guys, I said, do you think we could get Bono to FaceTime with Elsha really quickly? And he goes, sure, we love Elsha. So I got her on the phone, and I handed him the phone. He looked at it and smiled and said hi to her. Bono's coming down the line, and there's a handler named Brian who's always right next to Bono. And Brian's an incredible guy, does an amazing job. And Liam handed the phone to Brian. Brian saw it, smiled, said hi to Elsha, and handed it to Bono. Bono lit up like a Christmas tree when he realized that he was – at first he thought it was a picture of Elsha. He didn't know what to do. And then he heard her. And the world stopped around this man. There's hundreds of people trying to get his attention to sign stuff. He lit up, and the smile on his face was amazing. And he took about 30 seconds to talk with her, and everything stopped. And then on he went. And that said more to me about that man's character than him doing the interview with us. I mean, yeah, it was – you just had to see it happen to fully understand it. But that was a moment that just absolutely blew me away as to, how incredible this relationship really is.
Throughout the film, right near the end, I don't think I'm ruining anything, you discuss Twitter and how Twitter has brought everybody together. Now, is this true?
Yep.
Is this really true? Because you do harp on that, and you do kind of push it on me.
Well, because, in the story, it is true. You get your fans who will clamor or complain about this or that. There's always little family rows, right? There's always going to be little squabbles or arguments, and not everybody – it's not all kumbaya, Like I told you, there are fans who didn't like the fact that I raised money to go and make this film. But by and large, when you think of the fact that there are – you two has 17 million people that follow them on Facebook, right? There are very few of those things happening. And when YouTube people put something out there and say, hey, can we spread the word about this, or they share something, it goes crazy. It's an amazing online community now that has grown out of – this band's music, out of the experience of seeing them live, out of the fan meetups that happen, out of the GA line where people get to meet each other. I mean, it's all very real. It really is. And most of it, 99.5% of it, is all extremely positive.
That's great. I have one last question because I'm going to forget and it's going to upset me. How many times have you seen U2 live?
I don't even know. It's not as much as some people, but that I met, but I'm probably in the 50s now. I mean, there's a fan who's not in the film, but he's a dear friend. His name is Martin Ward. He's been to more than 200 U2 shows.
Wow. Good for him. I do have one last question. I forgot. Is there anybody you cut from the film you wanted to include?
No. No, I have everybody in it,
okay.
which is a pretty amazing thing. Now, we are working towards getting it into film festivals and broadcast or something like that. I cannot guarantee that everybody will stay in all of those formats. What I will guarantee is that eventually when this becomes available as a Blu-ray, because it isn't available yet to buy, I will make sure that whatever version of it that is available for YouTube fans to purchase – everybody will be in. If a network wants to show that right now, it's an hour and 40 minutes long, right?
Hour 30, I think.
Yeah, 1 hour 37.
Okay, I couldn't remember.
So, most networks are, other than like a Netflix or Amazon Prime, aren't going to air it at that length. If you get it on the BBC, they're going to cut it down to 60 minutes, you know?
For sure.
And if that happens, obviously everybody can't stay in it. So I don't have as much control over that, but whatever version lives on a streaming service or, that is available to purchase eventually, yes, everybody will be in it.
I honestly would say I could see this on Netflix tomorrow. Totally would breathe Netflix to me.
The real hard part is that I am a truly independent filmmaker. I don't have any connections like that, and it is very hard to get it in front of not even just a person at Netflix, but the right person.
Yes, I understand that. I'm totally with you.
Because you could get it in front of somebody and goes, I'm not the right person for it, and they don't have any way to submit films. So that's why you have to, stay the course and keep working at it. And I do believe eventually it will get there. Because I think we did a pretty good job telling the story.
I think you did a fantastic job telling the story to a man that, I'm being honest here, does not – I enjoy their music. but I would never consider myself a person to go see them live.
Let me ask you a question. Let me put on the interviewer's hat for a second. What did you learn from watching the film?
I learned that I really need to listen to U2's albums more than I ever have in my life and get a little bit more involved in the culture. I was so impressed by them. I'm like, I love I Will Follow. I love Beautiful Day. I mean, I love the singles. And I think I discovered the film. There must be music there I've never heard. And maybe that's why I'm not a U2 fan. Because I'm a very singles guy, and I know that about myself. So yeah. I will be honest. I've never heard a whole U2 act. The one with the fly, that's the only album I ever heard. Is that Locktongue Baby?
Yep.
Okay, that my brother bought that. It's the only reason that's the only U2 album I've heard the whole thing of, and I loved it.
Yeah.
And I tried to listen to Joshua Tree, and it was a little too mellow for me. So I said, okay, I'll just stick with what I like.
I would tell you, just if you get the chance, you live. Are you in Southern California?
I'm a Canadian.
Oh, you're Canadian. So if you ever get the chance to see them play live, go ahead and get a ticket and go.
I'm going to. You've convinced
because
me.
What I will tell you is that is the light bulb moment. Now, not everybody walks out of that building being a U2 fan, but I've taken a lot of people to U2 shows, and I can't tell you how many people have turned to me right afterwards when you're leaving. They go, I get it now. I understand why this is such a big deal.
Okay.
There is something – it sounds hokey or whatever, but there is – something spiritual and magical that happens when those four guys start to play music. And you don't have to like it or not, but you'll recognize it at least. You'll see it and go, wow, you know what? That was something. I get it now. I mean, you might not be a fan, but you walk away from it going, I get it. I understand it.
Okay.
And that's the thing.
Okay. It's time for fun questions. Everybody gets them.
All right.
Because I do film mainly, I'm going to ask you a film question to start. Your favorite film, because I ask everybody that the first time they're on the show.
Favorite film? I got to state my, you know, it shifted over the years, but overall, my favorite film still has to be The Shawshank Redemption.
Nothing wrong with that.
I love that film.
Now I'm going to put you on the spot for the next two questions.
Okay.
The favorite place you visited on your documentary tour?
Dublin, Ireland.
I didn't know if you were going to tell me anybody. I'm like, maybe I'll just say all of them. Now, this is going to be the hardest one, and I'll let you slide. You can give me five. Your favorite U2 song, if there is one.
This is a cop-out answer, but it's a real answer, okay? I am a guy that has bought into the adventure with U2. U2 was always a band that looks forwards, not backwards, right? So they've always said that they're excited about the new music. That's why I was actually shocked they did an anniversary tour for the Joshua Tree. And it made sense, and I get it. And the reason it made sense is, like, my producer Amanda, she's a lot younger than me. She never got the chance to see them on that tour. And I met a lot of people. I saw the Joshua Tree tour, you know, the original, you know. So I don't look back. But a lot of people never got to see it, and they did this time, and it was special to them. So I guess I forgive them for that, you know, for looking backwards. But my answer is this. Like them, they always look forwards, and I do too. So my favorite U2 album, my favorite U2 song is always the most recent one. So right now it is the Songs of Experience album, and it's literally the whole album, but the song that gives me the most emotional impact is probably Love is Bigger Than Anything in Its Way, and it's a song that you hear under the credits at the end of the movie.
Okay. Let's promote your website here or wherever you want people to I know they can't buy the film or can't see the film, but soon, very, very soon.
Very
so
soon.
Tell us where to go so they can at least send their testimonials to you.
They can go to the dreamoutloudfilm.com website, and they can follow us on Facebook at Facebook.com/DreamOutLoudFilm. And they can follow us on Twitter at Twitter.com/@U2FanFilm.
Well, thank you for your time. I think you're the longest running guest ever, and good work on that.
I hope it wasn't boring to you.
No, it was fascinating.
I'm passionate about the film.
Absolutely really loved it. You have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page. Thank you.